Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
This is Le Show from London. And when New Orleans is in the national news, it's not all that often anyway. And quite often when New Orleans does make the national news, all the facts don't seem to accompany the story as it makes its way up north. Most recently, New Orleans made the news because a major lawsuit was filed there a couple weeks ago against more than 90 companies in the oil and oil services businesses, alleging that they had, by their activities of canal digging and pipeline laying across the wetlands of South and Southeast Louisiana, damaged the marshland to such an extent that New Orleans was now far more vulnerable to hurricane storm surge than it had been before all this construction began. It has become quite a controversial lawsuit, and so I wanted to take the opportunity of inviting a friend who is, as it happens, a key figure in the lawsuit to be with me today. He's in Washington, D.C., and he's the noted author of Rising Tide, the definitive book on the 1927 Mississippi River flood, which gave us, among other things, a beautiful Randy Newman song and the execrable blanket immunity from any lawsuit for the United States Army Corps of Engineers. He's John Barry. You have nothing to do with either of those things. You bear no responsibility for that. But John is also a member of the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East, if I got that right.
You did.
Wow.
I didn't create the name.
No, you think of catchy names like Rising Tide, right?
Yeah, my agent did that, actually.
Oh, really? Wow. An agent?
I'm not clever.
Oh, you're smart, though. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you very much. I want to correct one thing you said at the beginning, and that was that we are alleging that their activity damaged the marsh. It's not an allegation. It's a fact which they admit. As recently as yesterday, the Chris John, who runs the Mid-Continent Oil and Gas Association, conceded that we are, quote, partly responsible, unquote. They know that. The issue is who pays to fix it. What the lawsuit is about is that, I mean, first, to give your listeners some scope, our board is comprised of scientists primarily. It's a post-Katrina reform board. It's insulated from politics. Pretty much every other board in the state, the members serve at the pleasure of the governor. We cannot be removed by the governor once we're on there. There's a long process of selection, including the deans of all the colleges of engineering in the state and good government groups. That insulation allowed us to do what nobody else in Louisiana has done, and that is ask the industry to be responsible for what they've done and what they actually said in writing, in most cases, that they would fix. Our board represents or is responsible for the east bank of the Mississippi River in the greater New Orleans area. And there's a lot of damage in our area caused by oil and gas. Honestly, it would probably be several billion dollars if we win the lawsuit. However, the area to our west actually has suffered much more damage from the industry. And they have not, nobody to the west has yet joined in the lawsuit. There's a lot of Louisiana politics here. But we would guess that as we make any progress in the courts, and I think we've got a very strong case, then entities to our west would join in. And if that were to happen, the total dollars we're talking about would probably rival, it would dwarf Exxon Valdez, and it would probably rival whatever total amount BP ends up spending. So this is a pretty big deal. The other part of the context is, of course, Louisiana has lost 1,900 square miles of land in the last several decades, or since the 1930s, most of it in the last several decades. There are many causes for this land loss. We don't blame the industry for all of the land loss. We do say that they are responsible for some of the land loss. And as I said, they admit that they are responsible for some of the land loss. We are just asking them to pay to fix the part that they are responsible for.
Some numbers. The most familiar figure put forward for the land loss is a football field every hour. Is that do I have that right?
Yeah, about every 50 minutes, actually.
Yeah. And the percentages that have been attributed to the oil and gas industry I've seen figures that have wavered all over the map from 30% to 90%.
Part of that is because it's actually different in different areas. It's not uniform. In some areas, it probably is roughly 90%. Hmm. In other areas, it's very small. The industry participated in a study run by the U.S. Geological Survey a decade or so ago, which included many, many, quote, stakeholders, a word that I hate. But, that's the word people use. Mm-hmm. And the industry was one of them. And that study concluded that statewide, the industry was responsible for 36% of the land loss statewide. But again, in one area, it might be as high as 90%. Another area might be insignificant.
Let me take a slight detour before we get to the meat of the lawsuit and what has happened since it was filed. When we talk about the percentages of responsibility for the slow motion disaster that is the land loss in South Louisiana, another cause, and I think it's well known by this point, has been the levying of the Mississippi River.
That's correct. Keeps the sediment in the river. The land all the way from Missouri to the Gulf of Mexico was actually created by the deposit of sediment in the Mississippi River. So you keep that sediment in the river, and it no longer is available to replenish the land. So that's one of the causes, yes.
When the river used to flood, it would build delta willy-nilly, and now that same sediment goes down into a big hole in the Gulf of Mexico. Is that right?
That's right, and that's to benefit the shipping industry, so that that land building process used to create enormous sandbars that blocked the entire Mississippi River system from the ocean. So they built these jetties that go 2.5 miles out into the Gulf to carry that sediment and to open up the, 60% of our grain exports go down the Mississippi River, and if it weren't for those jetties, they couldn't do that.
You also told me, and this is the only thing that I had to cut out of, you appeared in The Big Uneasy, my documentary about the 2005 flood, and the only thing I had to cut out, unfortunately, was a point you made that five dams on the Missouri River, impound, what, a third of the sediment that used to flow down the Mississippi to the Delta?
Almost right. There are six of them in Montana, North Dakota, and South Dakota. There used to be 400 million tons of sediment a year coming down the river. Not all of it by any stretch goes out those jetties that I was talking about. But those six dams, there are thousands and thousands of dams on the river, but those six impound over 100 million tons a year, 125 million or so tons of sediment a year that used to be available to rebuild coastal Louisiana and sustain it. Those dams were built for flood protection, hydroelectric power, and irrigation. So they've been worth billions and billions and billions of dollars to people in the upper Midwest and in the High Plains and Nebraska and so forth, and they don't realize that they are contributing to the vulnerability of Louisiana to hurricanes. I mean, a point that may be self-evident, but neither of us actually said earlier, this 1,900 square miles of land that used to be there is a buffer for a hurricane storm surge. As hurricanes travel over that land, they lose force. Storm surge decreases. If you put the state of Delaware, which is roughly that size, if you put Delaware between New Orleans and the ocean, New Orleans doesn't need any levees. Just the natural buffer will protect it, and that buffer is gone. So that's why We are saying this loss of the coast has hurt the flood protection, made the city much more dangerous, and we would like the industry to fix just the part that they destroyed. Not everything. We're not holding them responsible for everything.
To be trivial, you're not contemplating suing the Corps of Engineers, which levied the river, nor the states of the upper Midwest.
No.
Okay, let's get back to the suit at hand. How did the idea for filing the suit come about? You guys have had your hands full in the post-Katrina world, supervising, looking over the shoulder of the Corps of Engineers as they've gone about building this $14 billion system. It didn't seem to me like you needed any more on your plate, and yet all of a sudden now there's this. How did this happen?
Well, the reality is the system gives us so-called 100-year protection. Everybody on the board knows what that actually means, and it's not very much. 100-year protection statistically means that, let's say you have a kid born today, and that kid's 18th birthday, he or she takes a six-round revolver, puts one round in the chamber, spins the chamber, and then puts it to their head and pulls the trigger. That's one out of six chances in an 18-year period you're going to get a storm bigger than 100 years. And then if they survive that, you put another round in the chamber, and when you get to your midlife crisis, you pull the trigger again with two rounds in the chamber. And if you pass that, you put another round in the chamber. So 100-year protection sounds great. It is the lowest standard in the developed world. The Dutch, the British, the Japanese, they protect cities to the 10,000-year standard. They protect cows to the 100-year standard. So our board understands that. And we recognize that to actually make the city safe, and incidentally, in the last 86 years, there have been four floods on the lower Mississippi River that exceeded the 100-year standard by a wide margin. Those levees on the river are built to a much higher standard. Mm-hmm. And if the flood 2 years ago that came down the river, if those levees had been 100-year levees, you would have had several million. It would have been bigger than Katrina, because those levees would not have held. So as we go forward, our vision statement, another thing like stakeholders I don't care much for, but whatever, we would like to achieve 500-year protection. And to get the money to do that is beyond our abilities. We can't tax the people in New Orleans enough to raise what we need there, and particularly when you realize that it is a national responsibility. As you said earlier, those dams on the upper Missouri are a major factor in our vulnerability, increasing the danger down here. The navigation industry, as I said earlier, those jetties that carry the sediment out into the deep water of the Gulf where it's wasted, that's certainly national. That grain comes from the upper Midwest. We import and export and distribute all over the country through the Mississippi River system. So we think there is a responsibility for the nation to take care of it. And then in addition, the oil industry, which, as I said, agreed and signed off on a scientific study that placed this, allocated 36% of the causation for statewide land loss to them. And we simply feel if they come up with the money to either repair, do it themselves, we want them to stop sending more water our way and either do what they already promised to do in written agreements when they got permits to dredge these canals, or pay us some money so we can build better flood protection. We think that's a way that we can increase the level of flood protection for the New Orleans metropolitan area.
And these canals, part of the problem with them is that their walls have been, eroding over the years?
That's correct. There are roughly statewide 10,000 miles of canals and pipelines that have been dredged through the marsh, and every inch allows saltwater intrusion. So the root, the plants die, the roots die, and the soil just melts into the ocean. So the canals, banks have widened enormously, and they were the permits that, in near the overwhelming majority of cases, the permits require the companies to maintain and restore. They're supposed to maintain these canals as they are, not allow them to erode, and in addition, restore. If they're done using them, they're supposed to fix it, put it back the way it was before. They haven't done either of those things. And they're, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, we're as a species, we're so good at putting back things the way they were before. So whose idea was it? I mean, how did this idea for a lawsuit come about?
I don't want to get, I guess it was probably my idea, but I talked with other people about it. You know, I was thinking not so much legal theories, but thinking about the tobacco lawsuits. Mm-hmm. And the individual smokers kept suing tobacco companies and losing because they'd had a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And they had been warned, and they did it anyway. In addition, you couldn't prove any particular individual's cancer was caused by smoking. But the states, who had these huge medical expenses for Medicaid to take care of cancer patients who smoked, they didn't have a choice. The law required them to take care of these people. And statistically, even though there's multiple causation for cancer, statistically it's very demonstrable that smoking contributes to cancer, heart disease, and stroke, and other things. So the states won enormous lawsuit against the tobacco industry for these huge medical expenses that they had. I thought conceptually we were sort of in the same position, mm-hmm. that we had this obligation to protect people's lives and take care of the flood protection system. And our ability to protect people's lives and property is severely compromised by the loss of coastal land. And so it seemed logical that one of those entities or the industry, which was responsible for a significant part of the land loss, frankly, might be a target.
Did not your colleagues, when this idea was first floated, regard you as somewhat crazy?
I will tell you that at no time did any colleague seriously question going forward. We discussed it in executive session, so it's not on the public record, obviously. You talk about a lawsuit.
Yeah.
That's executive session. And you don't vote in executive session. All the votes are public.
Mm-hmm.
Every conversation we had about it, the board was unanimous.
Wow.
On going forward.
Okay, now you file this suit. And everybody knows lawsuits are a long-term proposition. Nothing happens fast. But one thing that has happened fast is reaction from the political establishment in the state of Louisiana. Mm-hmm. Let me start with the Governor Bobby Jindal, who did not waste any time in stating publicly that he thought this was an unnecessary and a wrongheaded action that your board was not authorized to take. He, I believe, mm-hmm. claimed that you had to get a sign-off from the governor.
From him.
From him,
right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And your position, as I understand it, is you don't have to do that. You can get a sign off from the Attorney General and you're good to go with that. Is that right?
That's correct. We knew our authority would be challenged. Before I ever approached an attorney, our counsel looked at the law, concluded we could do it. Separately, the Attorney General's office looked at the law, concluded we could do it. Our attorney, who is being paid on contingency, and therefore it's his money at risk, and he'd already he's put in, because he's been working on this for months prior to being hired or even being hired, much less filing the lawsuit. He's put out hundreds of thousands of dollars of cash already, not to mention, I'm sure, at least 1,000 hours of time. So he had to satisfy himself that we had the authority. And then once we formally hired him, which was, he's been working on this since last fall, but we didn't actually legally hire him until July 17th, which was after we got the Attorney General's approval. The Attorney General also had to look at the contract. He knew what it was about. He understood the political ramifications. But it's a valid contract, and he really had no choice. I don't know what his position is on the lawsuit, but my understanding is I heard that inside his office he was advised that he had to approve it.
And he is, like the governor, he is a Republican, right?
He's a Republican, yes. And I would note that the governor, when he was a state cabinet secretary for the equivalent of Health and Human Services, he actually opposed the state of Louisiana joining in the tobacco lawsuit, which the attorney general was filing for the state. The attorney general in Louisiana is an elected office separate from the governor. Mm-hmm. And the governor and Bobby Jindal at that time opposed going forward and tried to stop it in court. But the attorney general had the authority to sue for the state. He did sue, and Louisiana picked up $4 billion, which they would not have had if the now governor Jindal had his way.
That's admirable consistency on his part over some 16 or 17 years of a political career, have to say that. One of the people who spoke out in the wake of the governor's denunciation of the suit was a gentleman by the name of Garrett Graves, who is head of the, I'm going to not remember this acronym correctly, but it's the CPRA. It's the Coastal Preservation and Restoration.
Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority, board on which I sit.
Of the state of Louisiana.
That's correct.
And I think most people who've paid attention to this stuff have tended to regard Garrett Graves as kind of a good guy.
Garrett is very capable. I really and truly think he's done a terrific job. If you look at where the state was when he came in and where we are now, you know, have we agreed on everything? No, but who would? Mm-hmm. But I'm not just saying this. I think Garrett has really done a fine job as head of the CPRA, and I think the governor has been a good, very good governor for the coast.
Hmm. So Garrett Graves went public, I think, within a week of the filing of the lawsuit, saying pretty much not exactly echoing the governor's opposition, but saying he thought it was a bad idea. And both the governor and he have made statements to the effect that they would like to intervene and in the court process and get this thrown out. Has he contacted you personally? Have you had any conversations with him either before or after he made that public statement?
Well, we got a letter from he wrote to the president of the authority. I'm the vice president, although I'm chair of the legal committee and the point person on this suit. So he did send a letter, a long letter, to Tim Doody, the president, which I responded to. He wanted to meet, and we invited him to our next board meeting, August 15th, and I assume he's coming. We haven't had any conversation since then.
This is a state court filing or a federal court?
We're filing in Orleans Parish.
And
have filed.
And you're doing that because there are certain Louisiana laws that I think you've...
Right. There's the Louisiana legal tradition comes from the French and Spanish. It's civil law as opposed to common law, which is the English tradition for the rest of the country. And there's a provision that goes back to the Romans in civil law called servitude of drain. And that provision, and it's also in statute in Louisiana, has been for 200 years, says that one neighbor cannot send more water from their property onto someone else's property, period. And by destroying the marsh, the oil industry clearly is sending more water, increased storm surge against our levees than would otherwise be the case. And I think that's a very, very powerful claim.
It is alleged to be a novel interpretation or use of the law.
Well, I mean, the reality is the case law on that is so well known. Every municipality has dealt with it in Louisiana. Mm. And there's even a case very much on point that involves flood protection that's not all that long ago. In Terrebonne Parish, which is just out to the west of New Orleans. So although it hasn't been applied in this area before, it's a well-known doctrine. Hmm. And in terms of what court we end up in, there'll probably be an attempt to remove this to federal court. There are advantages and disadvantages to each. In the end, we decided to file in state court. But that provision, even if we go to federal court, would still be applicable because the federal court, when they try a case, they rely on the state laws that govern that area.
Mm. Now, as I've been reading the clips about this, it's gone beyond just... the opposition has gone beyond, we're going to try to get this case dismissed and thrown out of court, and we're going to go on a public, a publicity campaign against the perpetrators of this, or the bringers forward of this case. There have been threats which have made public air and public print that the governor's office is going to do what it can to keep you from being reappointed.
Well, I don't know if they've said that publicly. I haven't heard it. It's an obvious question. My term actually has already expired, June 30. However, it's a public safety body, and because of that, I serve until replaced. There is a nominating committee, which, as I said earlier, it's engineers and good government groups. They meet in October. I am going to reapply. If they renominate me, my name goes to the governor, and then it's his choice whether or not to appoint me or not. If he does appoint me, I got to get confirmed by the state senate, we'll see. I mean, obviously, one of the ways to destroy the suit is to have turnover in the board, so that you take control of the board and the board withdraws the lawsuit. That would take a couple of years at least to do that, because our terms are all staggered.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible. There are other ways the state legislature could intervene when they go in session next year. They could even dissolve our entity.
Wow.
This is a political fight. However, I think we have very strong public support, and I think, as I said, everybody recognizes that the industry has done the damage. The head of the trade association for the industry yesterday said we're partly responsible. The head of the same guy yesterday said it's in our own interest to rebuild the coast because we have to protect our own infrastructure. 18% of the nation's refining capacity is in Louisiana. All of that is subject to hurricane storm surge.
Hard to refine oil when you're underwater.
It is, and it's hard to build a refinery politically these days anywhere in the mm-hmm. country. All we're asking is, again, they pay for the part that they're responsible for destroying.
Now, you mentioned the possibility of the suit being withdrawn by some manner or means. I believe one of the opponents of the suit, congressman from Louisiana by the name of Steve Scalise, has intimated that part of your contract, the board's contract with its attorney, has a so-called poison pill provision by which if the suit is withdrawn, the attorney gets paid his expenses to date and perhaps fees too, and that this money would come from funds that you would otherwise use for flood protection. That's the allegation by Steve Scalise.
Well, first, Congressman Scalise. We've worked with him in the past on flood protection. Remember, everybody in the state, Garrett Graves, the governor, we agree on one thing. We're trying to protect the public. We're trying to figure out the best way to do that. I think the politics of oil and gas in Louisiana obviously complicate this. We've worked with the congressman in the past. We're working with him right now on some other legislation and expect to work with him in the future. That provision is in there simply to protect the attorneys from some arbitrary political interference in the lawsuit. If the board were to withdraw the lawsuit, they would have to pay them reasonable legal fees plus all their expenses. Which depending on, I mean, this suit, if it goes forward to fruition, it's going to take years. Mm-hmm. And there will be millions and millions of dollars in expenses. They've already started funding scientific research to allocate the what percentages of, in our area precisely, are due to oil and gas. With percentages of land loss and things like that, that's very expensive. The estimates for the cost of the lawsuit start at $5 million. That's out-of-pocket expenses, and they go up from there. If you start running any models scientifically, you're talking about a couple of million dollars a model, possibly. So it's very expensive, and this lawyer is taking a chance on us. He actually, as I said earlier, he started working on this in, I think I first called him last September, and we didn't hire him till July, and yet he and actually two other law firms began working full-time on this by January. And he was okay with not being hired and kept working, and I really appreciate that because he was taking some risks there and relying on our expressed intent to hire him. And I think I feel that I do owe him just as a matter of integrity, and that he should not suffer if politics forces the withdrawal of this lawsuit. There is only one other provision under which we would agree to withdraw the lawsuit. We are interested in protecting people's lives, period. If someone convinces us that there is a better way to go forward that will protect better people's lives, then we will follow that path. And whether that means withdrawing the lawsuit or not, we thought for a long time, as I said, going back to September and in January, the board started debating at every meeting, and we could not find a better path. But if someone shows us one, we'll do it. However, in that case, if we withdraw the lawsuit, everybody wins because mm-hmm. we will have better
flood protection.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a couple more questions, John. One, a political question. Louisiana is a red state, so-called, but New Orleans is a Democratic city. I've been reading the stories. I can't say I've read them all. Has any Democratic politician in Louisiana come publicly to the support of this lawsuit to date?
I would say that Senator Landrieu has said that we need to fight for coastal restoration everywhere, including in the courts. She didn't make a specific reference to our suit, but I think we're about the only one out there.
What about her brother, the mayor of New Orleans?
I believe I'll let him speak for himself.
You are in Washington. You know how the game is played. And one more question on this. As people get more and more frustrated...
get back to that, there are also several Republican politicians who have also kept silent. There are some state legislators that have attacked the suit, but there have been a lot of people who are taking a wait and see attitude. There are a lot of people in very Republican areas. Look, Our board, 9 members of the board, my guess is 6 of them are Republicans. I don't know that for a fact, but I'm sure at least 5 are, and I think 6. And at least 1, and I think probably 2, are Tea Party members. They are as strong for this lawsuit as anyone. This has nothing to do with partisan politics. Nothing. This has to do solely with protecting people's lives. To the extent that Republican or Democratic politics has gotten into it, that's very unfortunate. I guess the oil industry, campaign contributions and things like that is a factor.
In fairness, when Louisiana was a Democratic state, oil and gas campaign contributions flowed to the Democratic Party.
Without a doubt. No question about it.
Yeah. The last question on this, I guess, is this. As people become more and more frustrated with the political system and its inability to do big things or look long term, the private litigation system has more and more become an alternative channel. There might have been a time, let's put our imagination caps on, when a part of government somewhere would have taken on the task of saying to the oil companies, you got to clean up. I'm just positing that that's possible in some imaginary democratic universe, the small d. So the civil litigation system has become this sort of alternative. And the political system's response has been to, and I think we both have seen this over the years, to demonize the lawyers who work in the civil litigation system. The word trial lawyer has become, well, down about 5 notches on the list from terrorist in terms of a fear figure. Am I reading this correctly, that that's the way this is going?
Well, there has been 0 substantive attack on our position. No one has said we're wrong about the land loss, and no one has denied the fact that the oil industry agreed in writing when they were given permits for nearly all of this work that they would fix it when they left. So if you can't attack on substance, then you attack something else. The old story, if you got the facts, argue the facts. If you got the law, argue the law. If you don't have either, you attack the person.
You pound the table and yell.
Yeah, and in this case, it's a contingency fee. No question. If we win the lawsuit, the attorneys are going to get a heck of a lot of money. I mean, a lot of money. By the same token, if we lose the lawsuit, they will have spent millions and millions of dollars, tens of thousands of hours, and it's expensive enough that the firm could actually go bankrupt, I think. So they are taking a risk. And that is the system. The fact is, these permits were not enforced by either the state or federal government, and which is one of the big defenses the industry says. It says, well, you never made us do it. And in fact, as I went through the process of finding a lawyer, I tried a couple of entities that might do it pro bono, but they didn't have the resources. And one expert on this kind of litigation looked at it and said that actually the defendant against whom you'd most likely succeed was the state of Louisiana. I said, well, I mean, as one person, we're not going to sue, one entity we're not going to sue, since we are legally a political subdivision of the state. That would be a little bit odd. But that's for their non-enforcement. And that's not the Jindal administration. I mean,
historically.
Exactly. That goes back years and decades. That's got nothing to do with the present administration. Right. That would be unfair to take a shot at him for that. So, I mean, that's where we are.
Yeah.
They're
So what's the next development we can look forward to in this story? I mean, as I say, lawsuits crawl at a pace that makes snails look like Usain Bolt. So what can we look forward to and when?
Well, there are probably going to be some. The next thing would be the board meeting where Garrett Graves, the head of the state authority for the coast, will appear. And I guess that'll be a little bit of a show.
Is that an open meeting?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay. I urge everybody to come to the Orleans Levee District on August 15th at 9:30 in the morning. We actually hold our meetings in the Safe House, a room designed for our personnel to hang in the midst of a hurricane. It's supposed to withstand close to 200-mile-an-hour winds and wild storms and so forth. For those who know New Orleans, it's right out practically on the lake.
Mm. So it can certainly withstand Bobby Jindal's huffing and puffing, you're saying?
We hope so.
Okay. Let me ask you one more question that is unrelated to any of this, but is related to the New Orleans flood protection system. When it was being built, starting in 2006, the Corps of Engineers was prouder of no part of this system than of the wall across Lake Bourne that separates this so-called lake. It's actually a bay from the Gulf of Mexico. And I went to community meetings that the Corps held in New Orleans where they showed a 15-minute, beautifully animated rendering of the wall, how big it was, how high-tech it was, how it compared favorably with similar structures in Britain and the Netherlands. And when I was filming an official of the Corps of Engineers for my documentary, one of the conditions was that we film it out at the construction site of this wall so people could see the wall under construction. In none of these presentations did we learn, and we didn't learn until I think late last year or early this year, that at the center or near the center of the wall, there's a little gap, and there's the high-tech thing that's in that gap is a barge that's supposed to be filled with water and thereby made heavy enough to sink and fill the hole in that wall, the so-called barge gate. And last time you and I talked about it, I think last we saw each other, and at that point I think they'd tested it 6 or 7 times and it had never successfully worked. Now I'm just checking up to see have they successfully. Is it like missile defense? They just keep testing it never works, or have they made it work yet?
Well, first, even in the cases when it never worked, in terms of an actual hurricane, I mean we would have toes around there to push it, and the last several times they've opened and closed it has worked. And the original plan for that gate was that it was only supposed to be used once every few years when they were doing maintenance on the main gates, which work fine. It's gotten a little bit more complicated than that, and we were telling them that we felt that's more part of the system than you might think, because the current flows, there's another gate on the lake, but your listeners don't care about that. Long and short is, even if it wasn't going to close as designed, you get some towboats out there and you can push it closed. And the last few times they've closed it, it has worked. We are going, there's legislation in Congress that would keep that under the operation and maintenance of the Corps of Engineers. It hasn't passed yet. I hope that does pass.
Because otherwise the locals have to run it.
Otherwise we will be responsible for that and the whole surge barrier itself, the much more complicated and expensive gates that are the main entry point for the Gulf Intracoastal Waterway, through which a tremendous amount of traffic passes. It connects Texas, goes all the way to Florida. Mm-hmm.
When you say towboats, this would be happening during a hurricane?
Well, we'd have them on standby, and you'd have to close that gate, not in the middle of a hurricane, but well in advance of a hurricane.
4 days? Is that four days?
Well, if it, let's put it this way. If we have questions about that gate, and if we are running it, then we're going to close it on June 1st, the beginning of hurricane season. We'll open it at the end of hurricane season in November, period.
I mean,
is it something you worry about? Yeah, a little bit. But are there satisfactory solutions? Yes.
I guess my only follow-up question would be, why in all the presentations and all the expensive animations and illustrations and demonstrations did that barge gate never appear?
Well, you could ask the Corps of that.
Yes, indeed.
John Barry of the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority, East, and author of the of many, many fine books, most notably, well, notably in this instance, Rising Tide, the History of the 1927 Mississippi River Flood. Thank you so much for, thanks for filing the lawsuit. Thanks for explaining it here today, and good luck.
Thank you. And let me close with saying my standard line, which I've refined down, if you don't mind a sound bite. It comes down really to a simple choice. You want to protect the oil companies from having to keep their written word, agreements they made, and make them obey the law, or do you want to protect people's lives and property from hurricanes? It is really that simple. The lawsuit should continue and let the courts decide.
But I like the oil companies. All right. Anyway, well, good luck at August the 15th. I wish I could be there, and I'll check back with you soon. John Barry, thanks
again. Thanks a lot. Take care.
You too.
I guess I'm just lucky so-and-so.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, during the interview you just heard, I believe if you were listening carefully, you noticed that not one of John's answers began with the word so. That places him in an increasingly uncommon category of people who begin their interview answers without the use of the word so. The epidemic is spreading. And so this week, from Democracy Now!, the Tom Hartman Show, and our friends at the BBC, more interview answers that begin with the word so. So sit back and enjoy some answers that conclude nothing, but begin with the word so.
How does this blend with the Walmart campaign?
So our Walmart, as I've reported for The Nation, is a union-backed, non-union group.
Talk about the McDonald's sample budget.
So this is a document that was put out by McDonald's and by together with Visa.
What would it cost for these companies just double the wage, like to $15 at minimum, for all of the workers? You have Wendy's, makes something like $4 million every couple of months, the CEO.
So the way that the companies respond is to talk about the business model for the individual franchisees and their profits.
So tell us about the Zimbabwe Artist Project. What are you doing?
So what we do is we work with mainly women artists.
Can people at ZimbabweArtistsProject.org actually find art there?
So I'm sorry. When I'm here in Zimbabwe, mm-hmm. I meet with the artists and I purchase art from them.
Just remind us what 4G can do, what parts it can refresh that 3G can't.
So I think 4G is the mobile data you always wished you had.
Where are we going with this?
So I think it creates a much more interactive behaviour.
It's not without its problems.
So the reason we're a bit later is we required some additional spectrum.
There was a debate about whether that should even be called 4G at one point, I think, wasn't there? Because it's not as good as some other 4Gs.
No, so the LTE is the only one that's actually approved as a true 4G.
And I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, that no new feature of this broadcast has engendered as much a contradictory response as the Sows of the Week. Some people writing to say, stop it, please, and others saying, have you heard this one? Now, ladies and gentlemen, because we're told all the time that workers who attempt to maintain wage differentials between, let's say, a high-wage country and a low-wage country are standing athwart the natural tendency of global trade. There's this from Ars Technica, a blog dealing with tech matters. An Australian parliamentary committee has released a report encouraging Australian consumers to find lawful ways to bypass geo-locks, not geo-ducks, geo-locks, on popular software from companies like Apple, Adobe, Microsoft, and others. The report is a result of testimony given to the committee by representatives from Microsoft, Adobe, and Apple. Those companies do business globally but charge Australian consumers and businesses considerably more for the privilege of purchasing their products and services. Aussies pay 42% more on average for the same software as Americans. The differing answers as to why. Adobe says it offers a specialized bespoke experience for Australian consumers, meaning customized, but not. Apple blamed local copyright holders for higher prices on local iTunes store. Microsoft says its prices were set and customers could vote with their wallets. But of course, some other excuses made, explanations offered. Smaller market size, unfavorable exchange rates, different wage structures, the cost of freight and sales taxes. Despite the fact that software is increasingly digital and the marginal cost of delivering it to Australia is far lower, that doesn't appear to have made much difference in the price tags presented to consumers. So if you're a worker and you want to maintain a price differential for your services, you are standing against the tide of globalization. If you're a company, it's a geo-lock. Congratulations. And now?
He's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector. He peeks at no stoops. He's an inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
None of the $47 million that the U.S. Agency for International Development has spent on a program to stabilize Afghanistan has gone to addressing the sources of instability. That's the latest from the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, the SIGAR. After 16 months, none of the agency's essential program objectives have been met. The $47 million has been spent mostly on workshops and training sessions. The project is aimed at bolstering Afghanistan's government. Before the planned pullout, the program has not issued its first community grant, says the Special Inspector General John Sopko. It spent almost $50 million on conferences, overhead, and workshops, a bad value for U.S. taxpayers and the Afghan people. Participants in one of the regional programs are experiencing fatigue with the many planning workshops, said the IG. Such disappointment may actually result in further destabilization and disaffection. All right, then. And more than $15 million worth of ice purchased for Hurricane Isaac victims in Louisiana was allowed to melt or was given away by the state to private entities, according to the state's inspector general. The mishandling of the incident means 10-pound bags of ice, originally $2.10 each, ended up costing more than $28 a piece, including transportation costs. So next time there's a hurricane, get your own ice. News of the inspector general, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, quickly, the apologies of the week. A Louisiana sheriff, speaking Louisiana, has apologized for the arrests of many as a dozen or more men in recent years on charges that they violated an anti-sodomy statute that was ruled unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court. The East Baton Rouge Sheriff's Office had been arresting men who discussed or agreed to meet privately to have consensual sex with undercover officers. Sheriff Sid Gautreau III issued a statement apologizing, quote, to anyone that was unintentionally harmed or offended by the actions of our investigations. Sheriff said he had instructed his employees to no longer use this unconstitutional law. Never too late. Sacramento Mayor Heather Fargo called a report showing that black motorists are pulled over by city police more frequently than other drivers. Very disturbing, and apologized to those who have suffered from racial profiling. The New Haven Register has apologized to Fox News after Bill O'Reilly ranted against the newspaper for comparing Fox News to the Ku Klux Klan. The Register made the comparison earlier in the week in an editorial about the emergence of a local Ku Klux Klan chapter in Connecticut. Dateline Tokyo, Japan's gaffe-prone deputy prime minister, that is to say, Japan's Joe Biden, Taro Aso, has apologized after suggesting that Tokyo could learn from Nazi Germany, which he praised for quietly rewriting Germany's constitution. What I said in reference to the Nazi administration did not reflect my true intention, and it is very unfortunate that it caused a misunderstanding, he said. Germany and Japan, of course, were allies during the big war. The BBC's apology of the week. They've apologized for broadcasting a picture of the Duke of Cambridge, Prince William, with a penis drawn on his head. Enough said. You know that Ariel Castro apologized for kidnapping three young women and holding them captive. You know what else he said, probably. The boss of Twitter in Britain has said he was sorry to women who have experienced abuse on the social networking site. Tony Wang said the threats were simply not acceptable and pledged to do more to tackle abusive behavior. The apologies of the week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And just this final science note, the journal EcoHealth has published results on discovery of high concentrations of flesh-eating bacteria in tar balls collected along the Gulf Coast. So don't be eating those tar balls now, kids. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations with another special interview regarding flood control in New Orleans 8 years after the 2005 disaster. And it'll be on most of these same stations around the world through the facilities of NPR worldwide throughout Europe. You send 440 cable system in Japan around the world via the American Forces Network up and down the East Coast via the shortwave giant WBCQ The Planet on the Mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcsn.org. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com and available as a free podcast from iTunes, sideshownetwork.com, and I hear SoundCloud sometimes too. And it'd be just like not eating the tar balls if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much, uh-huh. The tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Exile and Hawaii desks. Thanks as always to Pam Halstead, and thanks particularly today to Brian Oliger at WTOP, the whole gang at WTOP in Washington, D.C., and Andrew Boyle at Studio 5A here in London, England, for engineering help with today's broadcast. The email address for this program and playlist of the music heard here on, as well as an amazing store available at harryshearer.com. And you'll find me, not that I was lost, at The Harry Shearer on Twitter. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of the Change is Hard Radio Network.